talk delivered in February 2004 on the occasion of the seminar Meditation is Not Enough, printed in Bodhyanti Parasparam Volume 4, Chapter 5.
Many Abhyasis are the opinion. This of course was expressed by a few people also here in their notes saying that this is not what we want, but anyway I will tell. Many Abhyasis are the opinion that it is enough if they practice meditation, cleaning and prayer methods as advised by our Master. Master himself has stated, and this was well brought out by C.V. Koteswar Rao by quoting the article of Babaji Maharaj on Tinsukia. Master himself has stated that it is not enough if we just do meditation and follow the methods as advised, and we need to develop love and devotion to Master. However, in the many mails I received and also during the course of discussions and talks, many make me feel that they have done the routine practice as advised and they need to get results from such a practice. This of course is true of people who are plus 55. These males are invariably from people who are plus 55. They have got a notion that I have done whatever I am supposed to do. And they have got also a feeling that they are following the commandments to the best without the deeper understanding of those commandments as is necessary. No remark on anybody, but the assessment problem is there. They have got to take into consideration the Pindadesh questionnaire before they assess themselves also. That's what we have already given. Some gentleman was kind enough to refer to that. This is a very interesting and a fairly common expectation. But there is much more than the routine meditational practice in the system advocated by our Master, which we call Satyapadama. The truth is that there is a lot more in authentically liberating and transformative spirituality in Satyapada than just meditating. What I call an authentic spirituality, it is not telling what is there in the book, what you feel. Fearlessness is an authentic spirituality. A person who has moved in the path of spirituality will never be apologetic about what he has got to say, because he will say what is the truth. Because for truth speaking, you require enormous courage. People who are afraid, people who are in the sway of fear, of anything for that matter, can never speak the truth. Anyway, the most important point to take into consideration is the way we spend the remaining period of time of the day when we do not actively do the meditational practices. Many of my friends and relatives even ask me as to why I meditate and even suggest that much time need not be wasted like that. I used to think, why should I meditate at all, but waste my time on this rather amusing exercise for sake of enlightenment or realization of what I really do not know. You really don't know what you are. It's a very amusing exercise that we are having. And while clarifying escape into the word nothingness, I wonder what my motivation is. What am I looking for, or even lacking for that matter? To think that our system is all about meditation is to misunderstand it. Many of us think, even as our Western country brethren attracted to Eastern thought and practice, often make the mistake of seeing meditation in the narrowest sense of going into a quiet room and closing our eyes. In fact, there is a lot more to these things, both externally, internally, and ultimately. The process of spiritual development is an integral and holistic endeavor. The concept of constant remembrance in our system is more similar to the mindfulness of Buddhistic thought rather than the concept of bhajan that is popular in our country. And this is not the same as meditation. Constant remembrance can be practiced formally while sitting and while walking, or informally in whatever activity in which we may be engaged. Being present, wakeful and efficient in all aspects and walks of our life, beaming with the awareness of the presence of the Master in the core of our being, is more important than any particular posture or set of words of prayer in which we are engaged. If we can't feel the master in the core of our being, I do not think we practice concentratedness. Whatever you do, how do we remember always master, sir? Surely not through bhajan. Master is efficiency. Master is perfection. Master is light. Master is illumination. And that shall be expressed in our action, in our talk, in our walk. Then you can say, I am carrying the master with me and I am in constant remembrance. Otherwise, I do not think you are in constant remembrance. This is a very, very difficult thing because the authenticity is missing. Because the authenticity is missing, only what we may call some sort of a routine practices, trying to remember him. Whenever you don't have anything else, remember Babaji. Recite his name. That is not authentic spirituality. If you have evolved, if you have got enlightened, you will not suffer from that. Because you are in the process of enlightenment, still you feel like that. Master asserts that finally we find the ultimate in us and adds further that it is ourselves. He wants us to understand that we are masters in essence and that it is only the coverings that need to be removed to bring to light the true nature of ourself. In fact, we are all masters by nature. And through sadhana, we only have to recognize and awaken to that fact. In reality, what we seek, we are. That realization is not far away. In future time or in another place. But in fact, is inseparable from samsara, the cycle of birth and death governed by karma, and found hidden in the here and now. It is not the sannyasi logic that I present. It is the grihastha logic that I present. Here, now, I feel my master. He is not far away in the Himalayas, far away in either Kailas or Vaikunth. He is with us. Feel him. Be aware of him. That's what Babaji says. In one of the things that is recorded in the book. What is the latest book? Okay. Silence Speaks. He says that the goal is very near you. Nay, it is you. The goal is not a far off thing. The goal is you. When you are purified, you are the goal. It is not somebody, some person far away, sitting somewhere, waiting, of course, with love. That is not the time. That is those people who use the word master, I'm afraid whether they really understand what exactly they are saying. That they seem to have projected the master out of their body and then try to bridge the gap through a very, very thin rope of what they call faith. It's a very thin rope they have got. Seems to be so brittle that it will not carry their own weight. They are not spiders to walk through. They are real elephants trying to move in the fine thread with all their luggage. Not enough. Some elephants are catching their tails behind. They want to travel. Having projected him, where to travel, is it not? So when he is with you, where do you travel? The lives and teachings of our masters, revered Lalaji Maharaj, revered Babuji Maharaj, Ishwar Sahaiji, Saint Kasturiji, revered KCV, revered Kumaraswami, revered Parthasarathi, and many more, apart from many tales in the classical enlightenment literature about karmically ripe individuals experiencing awakenings while engaged in all kinds of ordinary activities, prove this point more eloquently than any logic can. It is over 4 decades that I have been meditating for more than a minimum of 2 hours a day, and certain days over 8 hours. Strain in the physical realm was present in the initial days of practice, and it was all the time invigorating. The strain is something that has never made me feel bad about. It always made me more bold next day to attempt it. As any person who does exercises knows, that first few days is really strenuous. But later on, it is invigorating. That exercise itself makes us move forward. The same thing is true here. So far as I understand, meditation is more about being than doing routine practice. Master has advised us to see or examine our condition after the routine practice of meditation for an hour, and also after the performance of purification processes and offering prayer. Each day I was finding, after the influx of pranabhuti, there is introducing and unveiling of a new way of seeing, far beyond sitting or just keeping still. Yet I found, on my part, there is inevitably some appropriate effort, intention and attention involved. This is the way in which I try to warm up my condition. That's what exactly I'm trying to put it here. There is no other way I am aware of by which we can go about the task of being with the Master and be attentive to Him. Meditation is called by Master even as puja, as we may see in the commandment number 1. Yet, it is my experience of late that meditation is more of a listening to Master than the usual supplicants or so-called submission to Master. The voice of the Master is more keenly heard whenever submissions end and absolute silence in the presence of the Lord is maintained. So long as you are a slave of wishes, what is the difficulty? You can never hear God. I am but a slave of my wishes. What if? Last question, what if? It means you cannot hear Him, because you are asking Him to hear you, and He is a very good listener. He is not a bad one who cuts you down and then answers. He has got enormous patience to listen to us. And His time and our time is spent only in that. Now, if we shut up our mouth, if we don't submit our things, and be satisfied with what we are, then we can start hearing Him. Then only the silence speaks. Surely this means that we have left the realm of desires, not to speak of seeking gratification of desires, because majority of us are in this realm. Not only we have got desires, but we are also asking for gratification of them. Then the stage of intercommunion or receipt of authors arises, and in that blessed state the individual mind, and in fact the entire internal apparatus, is put off totally. If everything is put off, sir, through what are you going to hear? Everything is put off with what eyes you are going to see. Then when you come to the stage, you know what is. What is that? What is that? Chatushasya chatushu, shrotrasya shrotra. Then you will understand what it is. Till that time, it is a stupid philosophy, Vedanta. There is an experience by itself to hear God. And it is a birthright we have got, because we have a right to commune with Him. It is only we who do not exercise it. Because we seem to be always telling Him, you please hear what I say. You please see how well I dance. You see how well I walk. You see how well I perform. All the fine arts are covered there. All in the name of devotion. This is really the final state of constant remembrance of prayer. This is really the core factor of enlightenment. From my understanding of the Master's instructions gleaned through books and through the intercommunions, I have found several factors that I characterize enlightenment. I understood it, that is, that enlightenment, through the core of my being as a blessing splendor. The great joy of awareness of inseparableness with Him is another factor in enlightenment. The awareness of this intimate proximity grants a courage and a confidence that is beyond all rational understanding. With all the handicaps of the physical and mental functioning, there is a competence almost intuitive in character, and more particularly in the work related to spiritual health to fellow brethren. Those of you who have read Path of Grace carefully would have found these are the stages I try to express in the Rings of Splendor. There is a sense of joy accompanying every act of seeing, knowing and doing, which acts in an almost instinctual nature. The equanimity that accompanies these acts has in it, as though embedded, the nature of perseverance, concentration, serenity and analytical investigation. The balance of these factors is something that is usually not disturbed. According that is, these are the conditions of the Pindadesh, which are not disturbed, whatever you are. You can always analyze, you can understand with serenity what exactly is the composing factors. According to my understanding, there are actually three liberating trainings in the path of the Master. The ethical self-discipline, the meditational practices, and wisdom. This is where I am adding, some of you have added the ethical self-discipline under the Ten Commandments, compliance to Ten Commandments. Without the moral discipline and wisdom, I may state that meditation alone is not enough for enlightenment. Because that is what the sannyasins say again. I retreat to some forest, sit somewhere, put up with all the inconveniences. I do long days and long years of tapas, meditation, and I get enlightened. A myth that has been propagated in this country for over 3,000 years. We have to come out of it. Really, 3,000 years we have suffered. We have been slaves of that particular thought. Liberate yourself from that thought first. Then you can get really liberated. If we ask how to undertake and accomplish in the path of enlightenment and how to implement and practice these three trainings, we only need to study in depth our Master's books, particularly the one relating to the Ten Commandments he has given us to follow. This is where I would make one more digression to say, yes, my thought is yours. We seem to be sync. Absolutely, we seem to go in the same vibration. What more do we want to know? To say that we breathe Ramchandra consciousness. Be sure of that. Be aware that we are in his consciousness. Otherwise, your thought and my thought. He said, of course, I did not give you this paper earlier. Nor did you. But all of us said the same thing. That shows that we are living in his consciousness. We are not living in his body. In the sense of physical body. We can be left. But we are living in his consciousness. This is what is his message. That is the practical guide in a book form, while other books give us the philosophy and his modified Raja Yoga systematically. The book Towards Infinity is a description of the path he has accomplished. He has taken to accomplish what he accomplished, and eventually the same is the path we take to become just like him. I have tried to explain how the experience during meditation becomes our guiding spirit in the path, in the book Experience Becomes. True seekers would have noticed that in these Ten Commandments, the steps to enlightenment, they would have also noticed that these are practices that suggest ways and means to enrich ourselves with wise livelihood and sagacious living. These practices are not solitary or contemplative in nature, but engage us fully in daily life through constant remembrance that will be considered as mindfulness and loving kindness expressed in all our actions and talks. We should note that spirituality is never learned through books. Master, while writing about this book, said, "In this book I have endeavored to put up in words those spiritual secrets which have up till now come down from heart to heart." And also added that it is not only difficult, but almost impossible to express them adequately in words. One needs to live and understand the Masters to understand the way. But it is almost impossible without having the proper attitude, as simply staying with the Masters never help much. Physical proximity is good, but spiritual nearness is what is required. Love at work, compassion in action, spiritual and social activism, efficiency in discharge of duties without undue attachment, as well as devoting ourselves to the welfare of the world, is an important part of spiritual practice in the system of the Master. It is the practical wisdom that we observe in the Master that really guides us. It is an age-old wisdom that we may not do great things, but can do small things in a great way. For that, the path given to us by the Master has been very efficacious for many seekers. The spirit of soul, or even spirit, of every spiritual path without exception is some kind of basic morality and self-discipline. If we wish to live wisely and contribute to a better world, we must try to become better people, authentic people, honest, straightforward, and decent, and more particularly serve all beings unselfishly. Practices such as truth-telling, non-harming, non-covetousness, non-jealousy, peacemaking, balancing, showing generosity, and engaging in selfless service are too often overlooked by many in their urgent and mad rush to gain grace of the Master to achieve higher states of blessedness. They seem to ignore the fact that above-mentioned characteristics are in reality offshoots of small gains in the path, and they need to be nourished and developed by sincere and conscientious efforts through constant remembrance. Sincere attention to them may even be called as yogas, and in fact, they enable us to connect with divinity on a firmer basis. They then reveal to us an inherent beauty and sacredness of life, which otherwise presents a picture of meaningless detachment. Yoga, that means union, then only can be said to yoke us to the highest and deepest form of spirit in expression. Nowadays, whatever I am, I meditate and attend to purification process, and in a sense continue to live in constant remembrance. One thing I would like to state is constant remembrance is really sinking roots deep into the present moment and living in the present and not trying to think about the master or goal as an object of achievement in either the near or the farther future. If you can't realize God just now, you will never realize Him. He is not a goal to be achieved in a farther way. This is a point that I would like people to appreciate. Another important factor that I feel like sharing is that there are innumerable ways to worship and awaken. There are countless ways to kneel and kiss the ground, sang the Sufi poet Saint Rumi. Especially in our diverse, multicultural, pluralistic era, I feel we must be respectful and tolerant of many options people have discovered for pursuing spiritual development, even within each faith, not to mention among the different faiths. This has been our approach in ISRC, and I think we'll stick on to that under any circumstance. Moreover, because fanaticism can be very bad, moreover, we must be patient with ourselves and our karmic condition, and we should try to be more kind to ourselves and avoid indulging in expressions of guilt, shame, and self-bashing in the name of deep spiritual aspiration. So, kindly note this sentence. I try to put this as clearly as possible, because many people suffer from this. Moreover, we must be patient with ourselves and our karmic condition, and we should try to be more kind to ourselves and avoid indulging in self-expressions of guilt, shame, and self-bashing in the name of deep spiritual aspiration. Surely we need to repent for the wrongs done, but we need not kneel so low as to totally lose our awareness of our individual endowment and end up in self-pity. God has given us enough. Okay, we committed mistakes. We'll rectify. That courage is available when you have got the Master in your heart. He's always there to guide you. Yes, I committed a mistake. Knowingly I committed a mistake. Yes, I agree. I repent for it. I'll try not to repeat it. I take the assistance of the Divine in the whole process. But if you are going to suffer from guilt, shame, and self-bashing in the name of deep spiritual aspiration, saying all the time, I committed this mistake, I ought not to have done this, this is the wrong that I have done, that is the wrong that I have done. If you go on counting all your lapses, there will be no time for you to count the graces. Count the graces of God rather than counting your lapses. See what are the things that you got rather than what are the things that you lost. You got so much from God. Think about that. This is the most positive angle in spirituality. Spirituality will not suffer that type of thing. Religion lives on that. Religion has to necessarily live on the self-passion for its survival. Then only you have got the stock of that, I come to you, you will wash off my sins. I will beat myself like the tribal fellows, or I will come and put vadi kaanuka in your undi, abrada kaanuka in your undi, all sorts of punishment you want to take. You cannot afford that. Niludopidi icheskuntam. Why should you? Whoever asked you to do that? Small committed, Mr. Small mistake will come. Okay, rectify. You want to commit one more mistake. And in the whole process, make the temple rich. For what? For some other person to make business out of it. It's a disgrace today that I understand that many of the temples are self-prasad. And for that, why should you donate anything to that? Anyway, they are selling it. They are businessmen. Why should you donate? The self-bashing is required in religion. That is what is to be avoided in spirituality. Self-pity is never accepted here. Okay. We should learn to understand that the spiritual weapon of self-purification, intangible as it seems, is the most potent of moderating our internal and external environment, and to a large extent loosening the external shackles. We find the purification process works subtly and invisibly. It's an intense process, though it might often seem a weary and long-drawn process. It's a long-drawn process. We don't get clear overnight. It's a long-drawn process. It's an intense process. You can see its effect on you. Purification process gives to us may appear too simplistic. I'm sorry. Purification process given to us may appear too simplistic, but to practice this, we require faith. An unshakable rock-like faith that flinches from nothing. This is what is missing. You have got the capacity to cleanse yourself. No, that faith you lose. Then you try to say that this person will help me, that person will help me, and ultimately God will help me. God has never asked you to do those samskaras. Nor has he asked you to own up any one of them. And naturally, he will not take any responsibility for that. Of course, I am not confusing the system. The system is very clear. All of you have got a very good understanding of that. I will not go into that. Though I have many times stated that I am a slow learner, few agree with me. Otherwise, why should I be doing sadhana for over 4 decades? As master has stated, if only we enter into his consciousness, he would deliver us within a few months. Maybe many of the aspirants in the path can gain such an entry into his consciousness. One of my sincere prayers has been this, that all should somehow sneak into his consciousness to solve the problem of their lives. Getting into master's consciousness is tough enough, but living in the same is tougher. The purity of the consciousness of the master does not permit any blemish in us of any kind. That is the real problem. Total vacuumization of ourselves is not possible. The goal of reaching the state of nothingness is always a never-ending journey to the infinite. Infinite humility is the real goal. That is the real enlightenment. We need to develop enormous capacity to put up with our own flaws and inaction, fallacies in thinking, and prejudices in our relationships with Kobar. The end Kobar, by which I mean all humanity, not your brothers and sisters. The entire expression of the divine that we are aware of. Development of fraternity is not possible through intellection. The lowliness of our nature needs to get established in heart, in every sense of the term. This is a prelude to accepting others' mistakes or lapses. If you don't know how low you are, you will never be in a position to accept others' mistakes. Only because we fail to accept our lowliness, the problems of rage, outbursts, insults and prejudices arise. And these are the factors that need to get literally burnt into ashes and exhausted out of the system as smoke and vapor. Then and then only it becomes possible for us to develop greater tolerance and patience. Talking of compassion without these virtues of tolerance and patience is talking of the blue moon. Only when we understand that single factor of our acceptance into the pathway of the Master, which he expresses through the influx of his blessing splendor that we call pranabhuti, do we make ourselves eligible for any progress. This is what I understand by the word yielding. Many aspirants ask me how to develop yielding attitude. How else can we do it than by recognizing our total unworthiness for the divine blessing that we have? If we, in the path of Satipat, judge ourselves well and understand our real nature of unworthiness that gets remarkably worthy and noble, then it becomes possible to yield to him and stop judging others. That is the dawn of real patience and tolerance. This learning is possible only through observing the masters than reading the books. When patience and tolerance is developed, the way to develop compassion becomes easy to tread. Karuna is a very special quality of the divine. The lowness of the other is not a matter of ridicule, but a matter of sincere awareness of our own deficiencies. The flaw in others is a flaw in us. That is the key to move in universal consciousness. Or Brahman mantra. For those who are trying to civilize themselves in the higher condition, please note this. The key to move into universal consciousness, Brahman, is to accept the flaw in others as your flaw. Because we are one. That is the way you can be in the higher condition. Accepting these handicaps of our real being is a training required to attend to cleaning of others. Those of the trainers here will know from the manual, this is what we stressed. You must accept the other man as a master and work on him. Any flaw in him is a flaw that you are seeing in a master who is the master already covered by something that please remove that. If that is the attitude, then your work is great. Otherwise, it is what it is. We need to develop the capacity to evaluate others than judging others. Evaluate, recognize a problem and solve the same is the way masters teach us when we observe them. No book does this. Guru Kitabis can never reach this stage. Those of us who try to tell from the books will not be in a position to succeed in stabilizing themselves in the Brahman. You may know the system backwards and backwards. You may be in a position to quote the Gita from this side to that side, reading books, mugging it up, telling on occasions, express your scholarliness or awareness of scripture. For what? If the other man's mistake is not accepted by you as your own, you cannot be in higher consciousness. When compassion sprouts in the core of our heart, the seeds of altruism are sown. A small digression on altruism before I end this topic. The Tamil classic Thirukkural on the voice of God, I understand, says, the crow does not conceal its food, but calls all its kind to share it. Prosperity will abide with men of such a nature. I understand the spiritual prosperity of the crow as much as my forefathers, and I am sure most of you in this glorious land of Bharat do the same. One needs to practically know the ladder in spirituality, and one gains more by sharing than saving for the rainy day. What goes by the phrase practical wisdom is not many times compatible with real wisdom. The laws and codes of the lower human nature are different from the laws and codes of the higher human nature. Regressive tendencies and progressive tendencies are in fact the same line. The moral code of Shukra or Shukra Niti is entirely different from Brihaspati Niti or the moral code of Brihaspati. We know the former is the code of conduct of Asuras and the latter that of the Devas. No wonder there has been confusion in the minds of many who do not differentiate between these two sides. But it is worth noting, both are spiritual masters. And that is the problem. One gave this, the other gave that. For that population. For their population. And if you don't know which population you belong, as Krishna asked you to understand first, do you belong to Deva Sampatti or do you belong to Asura Sampatti? First of all, if you know, then you can apply that logic. But we do not seem to be knowing anything about ourselves. Excuse me here. We know, here in this gathering, we know that we are in the Deva Sampatti. When I said we, I am talking about the general public whom we are also facing every day. So let me clarify this. Otherwise, you and I will not be sitting here. We will not belong to the clan of God. We will not be sitting here. We will be doing many other things. Which side to extend our choice and seeing the masters, one can decide. The book on the commandments of the master is his masterpiece. I have found that reading the book is being with my master in every sense of the word. I hear his voice as audibly as I hear the voices of others here and now. The sound reverberates in the mind and I lapse many times into a state of deep contemplation as if I am by his side. His advice on the book or commandments, read it again and again. You will find each word and each sentence commendable, and when you begin to understand, I am sure you will be greatly pleased. I am, and I am sure you are. There are no important sentences and unimportant sentences in this book. In the brackets, by others. It's a virtue. That's what he says. Virtuous living is the key. And there is no virtue greater than the understanding that is infinitely insignificant, and master is infinitely significant. As I have expressed above, getting into master's consciousness is tough enough, but living in the same is tougher. It is obvious when we live in his consciousness, we have none of our own. I pray that this may happen soon, and we live and move in a world of non-possessive abundance. We have a lot of riches. Only thing is, we don't possess it. The world has got enormous. Vasudha is the name of the earth. There is everything. This is Ratna Garbha. The earth is available. Everything is here. One need not feel bad. One has no reason to shun the earth and run after the moon or the Jupiter. It is obvious that we can live like that only when we make a conscious choice to be with the Master. Meditation is just one aspect of the problem solving. As far as my knowledge and understanding goes, meditation on the heart imparts the basic message that we should maintain the delicate balance of the system, first in the individual, then in the cosmic, and thereafterwards in the paracosmic realm. In the three realms, three different laws apply, but the principle is the same. Be aware of the insignificance of individual being, and the absolute need to maintain the law of balance in each plane. One more factor that we learn is there is a progressive reduction of self-awareness and simultaneous awareness of the inviolability of the divine law or rhythm. The most troublesome aspect of meditation is the curtain of thoughts that we reckon with. This can be a thick one or a thin one, colored one or colorless one. But every one of us faces the curtain as an obstacle in realizing the true nature of self. This wheel of thought first should be recognized as present, and then one needs to peep within. This realization is often missed. Famous saints and seekers have appealed to the divine for help, as we find in the songs of Tyagaraja, Tera Tiyaga Radha, and Annamaya, Pannagappu Dhomathera Paiketa Melaya. These are the two songs that I remember, many more must be there in many other languages. There's a wheel. There's a wheel covering the divine. power in the inner heart, always. Somebody has to do it. Until and unless this is realized, one wanders ceaselessly in the mind, fixated in thoughts and forms, and trying to make it work, and wondering why it does not. The missing is neither cultural nor social. The fact that discontent is global, irrespective of the subject matter and geographical location, is enough proof of this wheel of nations. This civilized world keeps looking in sophisticated ways to fix it when ideas and circumstances fail. In the present day, we have many salesmen for ideas, methods, drugs, and enlightenment too, and they are putting enormous effort to the educators as to how to create the right circumstances, both legitimate and otherwise, to achieve our ends. But the fact remains that people keep seeking always something more new, and the solution, whatever, is not accepted. This is a problem of majority of the people in the beginning also. We don't so easily accept our meditation method. We've got other things in our mind. This exposes our insatiable quest. Please ask yourself whether have you ever known anyone who has entered this seeking and come to rest in any area of activity or thinking, except in the case of masters of wishes. Even the best possible circumstances always change. Ideas are limited and drugs wear off and have side effects. All this is dubious. A conversation with a dear friend has brought to light a preconceived notion that many entertain, and I share my knowledge with you here. This notion or belief is that the mind is a gauntlet that is impossible. This was understood by Babaji in his Reality at Dawn. This idea that governs so many is not true. Master has asserted that mind is the very instrument we have to use to reach our goal, and it plays monkey only in undisciplined persons. The wheel of thought is so thin that all one has to do is look at it and it disappears. Do you know this? When any meditation, you have got some thought, you try to observe that, it's lost. Have you observed this? Another idea comes, that goes. You try to catch the idea, it simply passes. Look at it, it is lost. We seem to be Basmasaras, right? Look at it, lost. Try to catch a thought and you will be unable to hold on to it. Just try and you will fail. This is what many persons complain when they say they have too many thoughts that are disturbing. They all disappear like dreams in the morning, and nothing you can do will stop. This is what the Abhyasis tell when they say they are not able to recall the thoughts and they feel they miss a lot of them. This is due to the habit of identifying oneself with the thoughts, the alleged thinker, or what the thoughts are about, what you call you, and then struggle as that falls apart, which it will in any way sooner or later. What can be said here is that doubt is a fundamental trick of the mind. It is the flip side of the faith, and both faith and doubt need belief to exist. In other words, doubt and faith are all just nothing more than thought. Neither has anything to do with who you truly are. Doubt and faith are not clarity. They are both the mind's pathetic substitute for the absence of clarity. When my friend begins to doubt that he and other normal people can never get out of the rut of mind, he is reinforcing things that are untrue. For this friend of mine is not an Abhyasi. One, first, that anyone not bound in the mind is higher or gifted in some unusual way. This is one of the myths they have got. Second, that the mind is a power. Truthfully, it only has the power that one endows it within the mind. You give, that's what Babaji says, a God, an idea of a God. You give the power to it, he says. It has no power on its own. It is the way you give that. mind is a self-appointed despot. Right? It has appointed itself. Third, that what goes on in the mind actually stands as real. These are the notions we have got. It is but proper that we should test these assumptions. If we are in fact who we think we are, then consider who we thought we were years ago or even yesterday. At that time, we had the same confidence in those ideas and we have in the ones today, that we have in the ones today. Yet, they do not exist anymore. In fact, life has shown us that they were utterly false. We may think that the ideas about us today are more accurate than in the past because we have more knowledge, and the fact is that today's sense of self is made of exactly the same substance that it was years ago, and that substance is thought. Therefore, the sense of self cannot be any more real today than it was in the past. Thought cannot be who we are. Mind is like any other part of the organism with specific functions, and it need not be deferred to beyond those functions which are useful. This is one of the fallacies of many people. That is why you should understand Indian psychology. Buddhi has been considered as a part of the antakarna and is not confused with the soul. Mind is not me. Mind is an instrument I have. Just eye is an instrument I have. Hands are an instrument I have. But this seems to have that, as I told you, the despotic character of trying to say, I am the person. Mind is capable of telling that. The wheel of thought is so delicate that if we look at it directly, it dissolves before our eyes. The unfortunate predicament of human condition is that the perceiving of reality through the wheel of thought distorts everything that is perceived. This is called delusion, maya or samsara. The problem gets worsened for all those who dwell in the virtual images of the small and big screen, and surely the computers. The more we get accustomed to the virtual plane, the more farther we move in reality, and poor mind need not be accused of this. This is again my appeal against people who spend a lot of time with TV, with videos, with cinemas, and unproductive computer activities. I should add that unproductive, because there seems to be quite a lot of productive activity. But computers, as are given on the internet, can be quite damaging. Damaging to the soul. Okay, one more information that I would like to share. One gentleman who had perhaps the misfortune of seeing the TVs had seen between the United States and Mexico, there seems to be some border where that particular film or narration was given. While the women, the children at the age of 4 or 5, female children, were lifted and they have been put into the most ancient occupation in the world. And people have been, it seems, indulging into all sorts of not only carnal desires, but bad treatment to them, and being unkind to them, harsh to them, cruel to them. This is portrayed. Okay, you have seen this TV. The point is, this person is a grihastha. He also has got the carnal desires. He knows, he is a young man, he knows his problems, but the mind has come into the picture now. It has identified him and his legitimate relationship with his spouse with the unfortunate events that he has seen in the TV, and has got into a state of self-pity. Have I committed a crime? Am I doing crime? What is this? This is a product of one, bad viewing, it could have been avoided. Number two, being dictated by the sannyasi ethics. Three, allowing your mind all sorts of imaginations. You are not all that bad. By being a good husband, you are not bad. Getting progeny is your right, is your duty, as it has been enshrined in the Hindu Dharma, that is their shrine, it is a duty. So the idea of looking at the relationship, conjugal relationship of the spouses, as if it's a sin, is a byproduct of that useless religion called Christianity. It is not Hinduism. It is not native to our land. We need not be apologetic about what we are legitimately asked to do under Dharma. And there is no way by which God can express without these conjugal relationships. Why it has been considered as sin is anybody's guess. It is not sin. Out of proportion, everything is sin. Out of proportion, everything is sin. Everything is bad. So you see the problem? How the mind hit him hard from an angle which he never expected. And that came from the small TV, small screen. Lock, stock and barrel, they deserve to be thrown into dustbin. But nobody will care for me. But a day will come when sanity will rule and insanity will quit human minds. Perception, we know, is not who we are either, as some of the modern thinkers hold. Because now one of the worst problems of modern philosophy is to think that perception is what we are. Mind is what we are is over, that period is over. Now some people have thought perception is, because without perception there is no mind. If you go blind or born without eyes, the seer is still there without windows to the world. This is my answer. Those people who say that perception is the man must answer this question. What is the source from which even perception comes from when the eyes are gone? It is my understanding that this source is the original prana from which all mind arises, and also the changing views of the world we develop, the perceptions. Once we realize this inside, immediately we recognize the outside. This is our nature, and irrespective of the degree of suffering or enjoyment, the reality remains untouched by those responses. Whether we are in the realm of the plane of the limited self, or have moved into the rarer realms of the cosmic or paracosmic planes, this is true. Prana alone exists. It is worth investigating this in the core of our being sincere. It is an enterprise for freedom in the real sense of the term, and without a true inquiry, there will be no enjoying of that freedom. That's our nature. We need to meditate in the silence of our being that persists in the midst of the most tormented or pleasured or any state of mind. Because people give me excuses saying that they're busy with the marriage, therefore they can't meditate, or they were busy with some demands in the house, and therefore they can't meditate. On both occasions, I don't think it's warranted. When we do meditate on the divine light without luminosity and touch the core of reality in expression, that is our heart, we see that it is untouched by both pleasure and pain. We see who we truly are and then enjoy our freedom. Many persons are in the habit of finding reasons and excuses for not living this freedom, and surely the masters were not very appreciative of this lapse in responsibility for one's own happiness. And that is why our master had to write a small and brief note on determination, which we publish in the Patrick. I shall try to share some more thoughts on how meditation is not enough. During meditations, one of the factors we should appreciate is that there is enough inertia of mind. Looking at the problem from a new perspective, we find that the highest state that can arise in the mind is the mind's ability to see its own limitations. Master had to many times tell me, and also on certain occasions warn me, of the intellectual approach in sadhana. It is not that by that time I was not aware of the divine possibilities of my little self, and to be fair to my master, I had considerable recognition of my mental powers. But understanding the limitations is, from my understanding of spirituality, far more greater than mere recognition of mind's powers. Because of this understanding that arose in me, I consider myself a blessed person. The mind can never take us beyond the mind, but the mind can recognize this fact very accurately. You can understand. To be able to understand what the mind can do and then to understand what the mind cannot do is what is attempted to explain here. I found enough reasons for feeling blessed when I understood there is no room for the mind and its doubts and beliefs and faith. I found there is no deception because this is a no mind condition. The head is gone and that is a great freedom. When I found myself not working hard with mind, I found that all that I am left with is truth, because I found truth does not change as a result of my effort. Truth is always truth. Nobody can change it. Truth naked is a reality that I encounter, and there is no deluding in this no mind plane. This is so simple, it is no wonder I missed it for decades in spite of master's guidance. Many may not understand me when I say that we have to work hard to get deluded. Delusion is not a natural state. It requires rationalization, fantasy, denial, and various other forms of artful self-deception to essentially rewrite and replace what actually is, namely our small identity. When I started thinking about the autobiography of our master and found how unmixed it is from any type of fantasy or imagination, I understood how hard I have been working to find a meaning to my individuality mixed with real and contrived notions about myself, and was desperately creating a story of my life. This lesson in insignificance is a blessing splendor of the master. The desire to write our stories is an odd one, and yet the number of biographies and autobiographies that were written and continue to be written is so large, we need to examine what it is that they try to express. I find that this is one of the most intimately and closely held desires of any reasonably successful person. The awareness of the all-pervasive presence of the prana should make any sane person avoid such an adventure in misinformation. One more caution before I end this paper. In any attempt at sharing personal experience in sadhana, there is a peculiar type of ego factor. Generally, there needs to be an element of truth to what the speaker is saying, and the more disturbing the truth, it is better. More disturbing the truth is the better. The truth is written or spoken into your forum where it will be recognized and agreed with, usually because it is self-evident. This is how we always talk about ourselves. We committed this mistake, we committed that mistake, we came to the fold of the master, we therefore thought of it. Now this self-expressed confession grants him certain amount of authority, of competence. And then we start then hearing, yes, this fellow must be telling the truth, and then he passes all stop to you. Yes, this is a mental makeup. I have gone through certain of them. I wouldn't mention any one of the names. This is the nature of the report submitted by about one's lapses or shortcomings or sins of commission and omission. There are certainly a lot of shocking truths in the world, and there is nothing wrong with speaking them. But that is one of the ways people help one another. Funnily, it is a lapse or omission that becomes the starting point of the greatness of the speaker or writer, and one's individuality thus gets established on firm foundation. Once an emotional truth is spoken, a truth that most people would not have spoken, there's an opening in the body minds of the listeners. That opening is a trust. The expectation that is thought to be set up by the author is simply that the next thing this person says or writes will be true, because the last thing he said was obviously true, and in that opening the so-called authority has an opportunity to say anything he wants, because the opening is there. The opportunity to inculcate even the most well-intentioned idealism rides as the truth into the body mind of the listener and most of the time goes unnoticed. This I added only to persuade aspirants in the path not to try to impress others with their personal experiences. Two things are achieved thereby. We serve our interest in avoiding that particular brand of ego, the tiger in the garb of goat and the aspirants of delusion. This is quite a price for the small effort we put in. The distance between insignificance and nothingness is quite a leap. The real state at this stage is spiritual. At this stage, spiritual life is jumping the ocean with neither the hands nor legs nor wings. We are just cosmic and paracosmic dust particles with no individuality and bare essential identity. Thank you. This is what I wanted to share.